this is a special podcast of a recording of the Soho Skeptics Leveson debate, which took place on the 17th of January 2013 in association with Conway Hall in central London. This podcast is brought to you by The Pod Delusion, which is a weekly news magazine podcast and radio show about interesting things, from politics to science to culture, all from a sceptical rationalist point of view. You can find out more about The Pod Delusion and listen to our regular weekly programme at poddelusion.co.uk. But now, let's go over to the debate. And here's, well, me introducing the debate. Hello everyone, I'm James O'Malley from Soho Skeptics, and thank you for coming, and welcome to the Leveson debate! Hey! we're an event jointly hosted by the Soho Skeptics and Conway Hall. Conway Hall is this amazing building that we're in right now, and since the 1930s has been London's spiritual home of free speech and free thought. So this stage has had everyone on it, from Bertrand Russell to the band Crass. They're an excellent member organisation. I do urge you to join up. They do excellent Sunday lectures. Every Sunday, so do join that. As for Soho Skeptics, we're a relatively new skeptics organisation. We're aiming to put on public lectures, debates, this sort of thing, basically, on around a monthly basis. We've previously had stuff on media manipulation. We've had Ben Goldacre talking about Bad Pharma. Last week we had a panel on women in technology. And our next event is Adam Rutherford talking about synthetic biology, and that's going to be next month. It's not all sorted yet, but I'll tell you more about that at the end. So tonight we're talking Leveson, and this debate came about because I imagine, like most people in this room, I followed the Leveson inquiry really closely and never thought that, you know, seeing people answer questions and look through binders with tabs in would be quite so exciting. And as we saw at the end of last year with the Leveson report, it's proved controversial. There's been almost a dividing line. We've on the one hand seen the awful things that the press have been up to, and on the other hand we've got questions about, you know, freedom of speech and safeguarding, arguing with power and that sort of thing. So I didn't know what to think, so I thought, let's invite these clever people here to talk about it so I can make up my mind, and maybe you can too. So let me introduce the panel. Here we've got Nick Cohen, the journalist, author and political commentator. He's a columnist for The Observer, blogger for The Spectator and Standpoint magazine. His most recent book is called You Can't Read This Book, and it's all about freedom of speech and this sort of thing. And you can buy it at the back of the room. And it's available from Newman Books at the back of the room. And I think you'll be able to sign books if you want.
Yeah.
Yep, Nick's favourite to sign. Next one, we've got Suzanne Moore, the journalist and columnist, who's written for The Guardian, Mail and Sunday. And many other publications. We've got on the far end, we've got Dr. Evan Harris, the former Liberal Democrat MP, prominent member of the Hacked Off campaign, who's and you know, Evan's, I've encountered Evan tons of times. He's involved in basically everything I'm interested in, secularism, all this sort of. Anyway, Evan's excellent. And next to him, we've got Dr. Natalie Fenton from Goldsmiths University. She is the co-director of the Goldsmiths Leverholm Media Research Centre. She has written a number of books, including New Media, Old Media, Journalism and Democracy in the Digital Age, and that's also available at the back of the room. So, and in the middle, our very own sort of Robert J. figure is this evening, Helen Lewis, the deputy editor of The New Statesman. lots of Helen fans in. So the plan tonight is to have a panel debate for about 45 minutes. Then we're going to take a short 15-minute break so everyone can get more drinks, buy some books and so on. And then we're going to come back and take some questions from the floor for, again, probably about another 45 minutes. The hashtag for tonight is #SohoSkeptics, easy as that. So, and do follow us on just SohoSkeptics. I think I've said enough, so I'll let Helen take it from here. Can everyone please join me in welcoming the panel?
Good evening. The Leveson inquiry lasted for 8 months. It cost an estimated £5.6 million. It interviewed 135 organisations, 474 people. We heard 36,000 words from Nick Davis alone. We heard James Murdoch say, "I don't know," 41 times. And like every bit of journalism, it even had a bit copied from Wikipedia. So we're now here going to assess its legacy. The report's been published. We know that there are negotiations going on between the newspapers and publishers and Number 10 about what the recommendations might be. And I really want to talk to the panel about what they think will come out of it. And in fact, whether or not they think anything really of substance will come out of it at all. So I'm going to start by asking Nick, the idea of having statutory underpin regulation, it's absurdly hyperbolic to say that's going to turn us into Belarus or Iran or China, isn't it?
Yes, but I would warn you that the struggle for liberty in Britain has always been hyperbolic. From the 17th century onwards, people have compared often quite harmless politicians to Louis XIV's absolute France, Napoleonic, Jacobin terror, Prussian Junkers, Nazis, communists. The reason you are free, the reason we are free, we have what freedoms we have, and I hope I can argue later we don't have enough, is throughout English history, people have put those who put restrictions on freedom, they've attacked them, and they have made extravagant claims, and people probably make extravagant claims now. You probably hear extravagant claims from all the time, but the price of liberty is perpetual hyperbole. So, no, we're not going to be turned into Belarus. But political underpinning, what's a statutory underpinning? What a strange phrase that is. It sounds like sort of Victorian corsetry or a house that's slipping down the slope. There are very real dangers in this process. If you have any system that isn't voluntary, first of all, you'll have Parliament passing an act and Chris Blackhurst, the head of the Independent, who is no friend of Rupert Murdoch's, you know, has warned quite rightly that politicians will start setting their agenda, and then you have this rolling place of a regulator, of a regulator assessing whether the new regulation works. That regulator will also be answered upon, and I know you're going to be a very strict chair.
I am, and I'm about to cut you off, and I'm going to say to you...
But look at what's happening now. Look at what's happening with people like Lynn Featherstone. Look at how politicians are suddenly demanding that journalists be fired for expressing an opinion, something I've never heard a senior minister in Britain say before. And I've lived through Thatcher when it was going bonkers as there. I've lived through the early years of Tony Blair when it was very authoritarian. Alistair Campbell was in his pomp. You know, these kind of things happening all the time now.
But, Evan, I would say Hacktoff has been
I was just thinking about Andrew Gilligan and Alistair Campbell.
Well, don't let us interrupt you if
no,
you want to have
a terrible thought.
Yourself.
This kind of rings a bell.
But I want to ask you, Hacktoff have been very specific about saying there's a very big difference between statutory regulation and statutory underpinned regulation, i.e. you know, you have a law that sets up a regulator, but then there is no further interference. But it's the principle, isn't it, that politicians shouldn't be making laws to regulate the press. They shouldn't be above the press. That's the problem here.
Well, I mean, actually, you I think you're challenging me to explain that there's state regulation over here. There's statutory regulation, that's where the state doesn't regulate but sets up an independent statutory regulator, which is not what Leveson did. And then there's independent self-regulation, which has statutory underpinning, which says, press, have another go, 70 years on in the last chance saloon, but this time your PCC model will have to meet certain requirements of being independent of you, of not allowing you to mark your own homework, of not being able to say that we are going to improve standards and not abuse monopolies, abuse power, and then actually do it. You can't have it both ways. If you're going to say that you're self-regulating effectively, then from now on, your self-regulator that you set up yourselves, that you're not compelled to join, it's voluntary, will have to meet certain standards. And if it does, then you'll have benefits in terms of if you're sued. You'll be able to say, we're trying, we're doing our best. So even though we may have breached someone else's rights, whether it's their right to privacy, their right to a reputation, a whole series of other rights, never been heckled.
We're shutting you down, Evan, I'm afraid.
I've never been heckled by a stage manager. But although you found that you may have done that, you will be treated more lightly because you're part of a regulatory system which is a self-regulatory system that's striving hard. So it's well away from even statutory regulation, which is itself well away from state regulation. My final point would be that it's no threat, absolutely no threat, to freedom of speech. It may be a threat to the freedom of Paul Dacre and Rupert Murdoch to do as they wish at the expense of vulnerable people. And the state has a role to ensure that that abuse does not take place without giving any power to politicians to interfere directly or even under this scheme indirectly.
And Suzanne, we heard submissions at the Leveson Inquiry from a lot of different groups. There were quite a lot of women's groups represented, for example. nothing seems to be likely to come out of Leveson apart from some form of enhanced regulator. So in that sense, wasn't it just a big, fat waste of time?
Well, I've had my mind today on other things about freedom of speech because of the fatwa against Brazilian transsexuals. But I would say that a lot of the things that the people don't like the press and are really complaining about, media ownership, Murdoch, the representation of women, and the ability of the internet to publish things that other people don't want published, has not been addressed by Leveson. So a lot of the issues have not been, you know, a lot of money was spent by, and I know everybody loved Anthony Jay, who I call the thinking man's Alan Sugar. But what was evident during Leveson, and obviously having worked for a lot of newspapers, was that you had this judiciary who do not understand that newspapers are not only a dying industry, but a business. And the whole point about a newspaper, whether you like them or not, is that you have to make a new one every day. It's a product, you have to make a new one every day. And that seemed to be totally missing from the inquiry. But when it comes to to Evan's point about regulation and the power of the state, which he's sort of saying, well, it's not really the state, it's something a little bit different to the state. It really reminds me of the old debates that I had as a feminist about pornography. There was a time when, you know, as a feminist, you hated pornography or you were anti-censorship, so you had to take a side. And the thing about the pornography that most people hated was already illegal. Child pornography is illegal. Phone hacking is already illegal. You can't make things that are illegal more illegal. What you can do is give more power to people, politicians, to tell you what you can read and what you can see. At a time when we trust politicians less and less, and there is more and more disconnect, why on earth would you do that?
Natalie, Suzanne raises the point that, you know, that we talked about the internet very little during the Leveson inquiry, and I know that it came up in the evidence of Martin Clark, who's the editor of Mail Online. Is there any point trying to regulate British press when it's operating in such a globalised marketplace?
Well, again, I would agree with Evan that we're not talking about regulating the press here. We are talking about a two arms length away from that. This is about setting up standards that the press are then required to be accountable to, but it's not about state regulation in any shape or form. Part of the issue, and Suzanne is right, that, you know, this is a business, and part of that is about an entirely globalised, marketised and heavily commercialised media. And so we're dealing with a very difficult situation where we think that there's a relationship between news and democracy, that there is the news, we frequently hear the phrase, is a lifeblood of democracy. But actually, these are businesses a lot of the time. And, you know, as Trevor Cavanagh said in his evidence to Leveson, you know, that this is a commercial operation, we're not in it for a public service. Now, if you separate that relationship between news and democracy, we're left with a very different beast. But most of us, and most journalists operating in the industry, go into it because they actually think there is a relationship, that journalism is there to hold power to account and to do, you know, to hold truth to power, as the phrase goes. The problem is, because of the commercial imperatives, the desire to sell has overtaken the desire or any democratic intent at some level.
But you talk about the desire to sell, but isn't the fact that people are voting with their feet for the kind of things that you don't want them to read? People are reading Mail Online in their droves. Ian Hislop said at the Leveson inquiry, you know, when these people bought the News of the World, what did they think they were getting?
Yeah, no, absolutely. There is a real balance between news that we say is in the public interest and news that the public's interested in. Okay, and we need both. It's not that we're saying all news should be worthy in that sense. Of course, there's news that people will go to, but there does need to be some sort of balance. We do need news that informs and enables people to make decisions off their own back in a democratic society. So we do need that process. That has to be fulfilled. It won't be fulfilled just by a global marketplace and the internet. That's a fallacy. And all the studies that we have in academia that will show us that actually news online largely replicates news that we have in the mainstream. It's not that we're getting a much more plural and diverse and sort of, you know, invigorated public sphere. That's simply not the case.
Do you want to come back on that?
Can I just have a poll for the audience? How many people here are journalists? If you raise your hands, please. Right. Everyone who didn't raise their hands, and I'm sorry to start off this meeting by insulting the audience, you're wrong. Everyone now is the potential to publish, to be a journalist, or actually is publishing and being a journalist, on blogs, even on tweeting, or on Facebook. This is not a secret. The web is not a secret. You know, I'm not talking about some arcane piece of nanotechnology only a few specialists know about. The web revolution has made the effective costs of publishing zero. If you have all you need to do is have access to a computer with connections to the net. I listen to people like Evan, I listen to Lord Justice Everson, I'm thinking, even though I disagree with them, there come fantastic arguments for regulation of the press in 1912, or in 1982, or even 1992. There is no such thing as the press anymore. When I started, we used to have this cant among journalists that we used to say, we're just citizens with typewriters. Apart from a few special privileges to protect sources, which incidentally Lord Justice Leveson is very keen to take away, something we might get to.
No reason.
Apart from that, we had the same rights any other citizen. That was true in theory. In practice, it was complete nonsense, because you could not be a journalist unless you were hired by a private, or to go to the point that was just made, we do have state media companies. You couldn't really practice. Now everyone can be, and you know this in your own life. On the one hand, you might be reading a heavily regulated newspaper. On another screen of a computer, you might have a newspaper on the other side of the world. On your Twitter feed, you might have links to images of, I don't know, the Duchess of Cambridge. Is that right, the Duchess of Cambridge? Kate, whatever. top social, which are banned in Britain, but you can see in France or America. It's very, very hard to break away from this notion, which Lord knows I subscribe to. I used to subscribe to. That is the press.
No, they're still incredibly powerful.
Journalism isn't even a trade anymore.
You have to actually look at the figures of who's reading what and who's watching what.
But only one third of the population buy a daily newspaper.
Yeah, and only 6% of the population get their news online, right. Their main source of news. Now, that is a really important issue. And if you look at the hierarchy of news hits online, they are dominated by the mainstream media.
One further point is really essential. Come and sit in my office. Yeah. Come and sit in Helen's office.
I'd love to.
We demand the right to be patronised.
You're regulating
you have,
a corp.
And you've done it very well. But can I just, firstly, Nick,
Evan,
you cannot define away.
Can you accuse me of patronising you? Well,
we can all patronise each other.
How clever of you to notice.
Evan.
Very kind. I'm troubling my little head about it at the moment. No, so you cannot define away the issue. You can't say everyone's a journalist, therefore. This is not about regulation or improved self-regulation of journalists. It's about better regulation, self-regulation, independent self-regulation of news publishers. In fact, the Leveson recommendations say to these archetypes of freedom that there should be a conscience clause in contracts for journalists so that they are able to withstand the bullying editor or proprietor that tells them to do things that are wrong. There should be an ability of journalists to report through a whistleblower hotline, this is a recommendation of Leveson, to protect journalism from the pressures of the corporate world. So you can't define it away, and I think it's only appropriate at a sceptic meeting to do a little fact check, especially since Nick said that the price of liberty was perpetual inaccuracy. Well, he said hyperbole, but let's say inaccuracy or untruth.
Well, that's inaccuracy there are and untruth, Evan. You're imitating the very tabloid journalist you claim to despise.
You said hyperbole, but I just wonder whether it is inaccuracy. So, for example, you said there was no mention, it was suggested there was no mention of the big commercial pressures. In the introduction to the report, the first chapter is... one, context. Two, commercial pressures facing the press. Part C, page 93.
I'm going to read this disallow report. You because we all start reading.
And finally, all right. So finally,
the end of time.
The internet not mentioned. Apparently, there are 600 mentions. Okay, of internet, website, blog, Twitter. Altogether, I mean, it's just a word, I know, but it's indicative compared to 100 mentions of magazines. So the idea that Leveson didn't understand the importance of the need to capture the conduct of, for example, Mail Online and news publishers online is just a falsity.
I didn't say, yes, it's going to be hard to keep up with Evan tonight. I didn't actually say Leveson made no mention of commercial context. I said, this is the commercial context, it's a dying industry.
Suzanne who mentioned
Suzanne
that.
And Nick, can I put it to you that the PCC was crap?
Yeah absolutely. No question.
If we don't reform it, is that not inevitably saying
I don't think anyone is arguing against that.
But how would you reform it?
Okay,
then?
Various things, but can I just say to Evan and to his hacked off colleagues, I have never seen a more tabloid-run campaign than the one that you ran.
Is that a compliment?
I like tabloids, you know. But, you know, you parade the victims of Dowlers against Hugh Grant. I'm sorry. I do not give a fuck about Hugh Grant. I do not care if Steve Coogan's morality, who takes his money from Murdoch, please give me a break. I'm sorry. I just don't see
what ad hominem attacks have to do with this. I mean, so firstly, we're not against tabloids, okay?
You don't see.
I read the tabloids, so to say that it's a tabloid campaign is not an insult.
No, I don't.
In fact, to any campaigner, actually, if you look at the track record of newspapers like the one you write to, it's amazing what the power of tabloid campaigning.
So I take it as a compliment.
Sorry?
Which newspaper do I write for?
Well, I thought you used to have a column, didn't you, in the newspaper I read on a Sunday?
Saturday. I used to, but I don't anymore. Right,
Suzanne, if we agree that the PCC...
You can't attack people who write for tabloids. That's not what we're about. Evan, you may be about
yes,
it.
Yes, a lot of the attack... And can I just say that... And I've done several of these meetings, and I absolutely understand the hatred people feel about the invasion of privacy and some of the dreadful things that some of the tabloids and Murdoch and stuff has done. But we are all hypocrites. If you ask people what they want to read and then you ask them what they do read, what they want to read is incredibly interesting international news, investigative news, and they don't want celebrity gossip. And you make that newspaper, and believe me, I did. We worked on The Independent when it started. We worked on The Sunday Correspondent. People didn't buy it. Now, you can make all the kind of political arguments you like about what I would really love, if I could choose anything to come up with Leveson, is a bloody brilliant left-wing tabloid. And that's what I would like, and I can't see it happening, because the only people who can afford to buy newspapers because they're running at a loss are
Russian oligarchs. But Hacktoff has never argued against celebrity gossip. Even if you take, I don't know, Coogan, okay, I don't know what he did to deserve your wrath more than, say, Murdoch and Dacre, but if you're going to be ad hominem, let's deal with that perspective. What his complaint was, that they wrote about a friend of his mental health condition and accused him, falsely, of causing his suicide attempt, okay, and refused when it was shown to be wrong to retract that, which was devastating for the family of his friend, okay? So the victims of this are not the celebrities, if you ask them. Same with Hugh Grant. What happened was an attack on a private individual who was the mother of his child. She has done nothing to deserve to have photos of her taken privately, exposed across the Mail and the Sun. So this is it's easy to make ad hominem attacks on individuals,
the point. There's a very simple law. After Diana died, you don't use long lens paparazzi shots that can be enforced.
Natalie, can I ask you, why do we need specific laws to control the press or to regulate the press or to oversee what they do? Why aren't the laws of the land that apply to everybody enough?
Well, they've failed, basically, and they've not been enforced, and that is because you have to look at it as a broader systemic issue. It is not just about what the press do on a daily basis, the relationship with the political sphere with Westminster Village in particular. It's the relationship with the police, and it's a, you know, it's a much broader issue about how corporate enterprises have gathered too much power and been able to run roughshod, actually, over the law. Now, the way you address that is by trying to somehow hold that power to account and say, actually, no, you know what? There are things that you can't do which run over all laws, all, you know, sort of ethics, and or, you actually do have to be held to account on codes that you write yourself, on the law that, of the land that stands. This is not about creating new law in that sense. It's simply about saying, how do we enforce standards that already exist?
And Nick, I would ask you in that case, isn't there an argument then that you're saying effectively, if without this reform, that victims of hacking are kind of collateral damage of a greater good, of freedom of the press?
No, because hacking's a crime.
Yeah.
It's a crime to hack phones. The last count I did...
And yet they weren't prosecuted for decades.
Hold on, Helen. The last count I did, 100 journalists and sources have been arrested. That number is certainly rising. It is perfectly possible that in a year's time there will be more journalists in prison than in Iran or Turkey. Yeah, the law is being enforced. The real problem, oh, I've got lots of problems with hacks off, but the big one I've got is this. With the internet revolution, there's an explosion of speech and publication. What we need is a legal revolution to match the revolution in communications technology. That would mean taking on some big vested interests, particularly in law. You would have to make access to the law cheap, both for... this is a sceptic audience, and I'm sure there are people in this hall who've published blogs or written posts on alternative health or against Scientology, and suddenly had that gut fear in the stomach that this could cost them everything they've ever had. You need to make law cheap, you need to take on the lawyers. But instead of doing that, I mean, I guess keep looking at all these people talking about Leveson, and some of them using the language of the left, and I'm thinking, can't you see an establishment stick shop when it's in front of your eyes? People were saying before Leveson began, Cameron will never recover from this. Cameron gets away scot-free. People were saying that Jeremy Hunt... Let me finish. Jeremy Hunt, even the dogs in the street knew that Jeremy Hunt had had a corrupt deal with Murdoch. He gets away scot-free. Even Rupert Murdoch, he can't be pleased by what's happened. But, you know, like Lord Hutton with the Iraq War, Leveson doesn't lay into him. He doesn't write a report so damning of Murdoch that the English establishment has to say, actually, you're not a fit and proper person to run B Sky B. What he does is attack a general liberty. What he does is set up a structure, which, I'm sorry, I hope Evan's right, but you have got one parliament producing an act. You've got a rolling thing with an assessor assessing it. The possibilities of political interference are huge. You've got, moreover, removal of what little protection journalist sources had. And these, I'm not talking about the journalists that Natalie's talking about. I am talking about serious journalists who are in journalism for the right reason are very, very worried about what's going on. I wish Sean O'Neill from The Times were here, the crime correspondent, or Sandra Laville from The Guardian, because they say to me, the coercive arm of the state, which you want to leak, you want it as leaky as hell. And yes, sometimes they leak about a celebrity, and it's a trivial story. I don't know, I'm sorry for Suzanne Evan, I didn't even read the tabloids. But that is what a free society is like. Trivial stuff comes out and important stuff comes out. And they're saying the whole thing is shutting down. Because Leveson at one point, when one of the few people who start trying to raise the concerns of investigative journalists to him, says, well, you know, if you can't have police officers talking to journalists, he says, oh, I've got this wonderful idea. I'll have a police hotline. And if you're dissatisfied with someone, you can phone this hotline and complaint will be investigated internally. This is the dream of every bureaucrat in history. Shut people up. Don't let the information leak. You can trust us. The internal structures work.
Evan, can we address that point about sources?
None of that was right, OK? Firstly, there is no attack. None of it was right. Let me give you an example, because there's this talk about sources. There's not a single recommendation, got them here, read it, that has an attack on sources.
You better be right about this. You better be right about this.
Hang on. Just let me finish my point, OK? So let's take data protection, OK? Because the press are concerned that there may be an attack on their sources. Let's take the one case of, I think there were several hundred journalists employing a private investigator and his network in the Motorman files to get private information, health records, driving licenses, friends and family phone numbers for thousands of people. Not a single one of them was an arms dealer. Not a single one of them was Jimmy Savile. Not a single one of them was a corrupt politician. Of all these thousands, they were all non-public interest stories which the law was breached and this data was mined and held and probably still held on individuals and lives were damaged. And we know that this information was passed on to people who went to hack. Okay? Now, you just cannot have a data protection regime that fails to protect the rights of individuals to have their information and who they are phoning kept secret from Paul Dacre and Rupert Murdoch.
You say everything is wrong.
Okay, hang on.
And you talk about an entirely different subject.
So it's been claimed by Nick and Suzanne that in somehow hacked off what more illegality. If you read our tabloid 120-page consultation and 33 clause schedule 2, it's very tabloid, the sort of stuff that Professor Cathcart, Professor Fenton, Dr. Moore, Professor Barnett come up with. A terrible bunch of tabloidies. If you look at what we've called for, more public interest offences, so less illegality, whether it be in libel, or whether where we support libel reform, or whether it be in respect of hacking, where if Jimmy Savile's phone had been hacked by all these newspapers who say they are critical to get to the truth, but never bothered once, even after he died, to look at it, even though they knew, then they would have a defence. Okay, so that's the sort of approach we want to see. You cannot, this is my final point, Helen, you cannot have a system where saying it's all illegal, the police need to do their work better. Okay, because I don't think you should have police in the newsroom. Okay, it's far better that the press are able to regulate themselves so the law is not broken, or where it is on a prima facie basis, there is a clear record of a reasonable belief that the action was taken in the public interest. That doesn't happen at the moment, and the answer is not asking the police to be more proactive on content or news gathering. We need to rely on better independent self-regulation to do it.
Nick.
There's a touch of the tabloid man about Evan. Look, just because it's important, and you said you don't want police in the newsroom, there aren't any news reporters left in the newsrooms. I wasn't talking about data mining. I was talking about Lord Leveson's suggestion that paragraph 2B of Schedule 1 of the Police and Criminal Evidence Act of 1984 be repealed. This is a part of the Criminal Evidence Act that says to the police, if you want, you have to exhaust every other option before you go for a journalist's sources. Now, if that goes, the cops will just say, well, look, Natalie, she's spoken to people we don't like, she's said things, I'm assuming you're a journalist, Natalie. She's probably found some information we want to have. We will go to her first, because it's the easy thing to do. Of course it is. That will mean confidential sources dry up. This is what I said to me about this being such an establishment stitcher, is that if you lose that confidentiality of sources, it's very interesting that Leveson is saying, I'm a moral force on the press. Virtually the only one moral principle journalists have is you go to prison rather than betray your sources. You do anything rather than betray your sources. There's a very fine journalist I'm sure you've heard of in Northern Ireland called Suzanne Breen. And the police service of Northern Ireland came after because she had interviewed the absurdly titled dissident Republicans. It makes them sound like Solzhenitsyn. They're terrorists. But she had interviewed them, and the cops wanted her notes. And in the end, Suzanne was first to say, look, not just will no one speak to journalists again, my life can be in danger if I hand over these notes. So, you know, be very careful. Be very, very careful of when you hear these cue words, Murdoch, Dacre, responding like Pavlovian dogs, you know, of just going boo hiss. Murdoch and Dacre are yesterday's men. They are a dying breed. But if not, and I fully accept what Evan said, that in the hacked-off document there's public interest defences in all free speech cases. That's very good. It's not in Leveson. What is in Leveson is a bureaucratic establishment system that will make it far harder for those journalists and, I keep repeating, bloggers, writers, anyone on the net, to find out what is going on in the state.
It's just that you can't make up a provision. So the PACE provision is not Leveson saying something must change. Nick's description of the impact of the PACE proposal is not what he says it is, okay? But even if it was, the recommendation is that the Home Office should consider and, if necessary, consult upon a change. So I don't accept that the change is anything other than ensuring that that newspapers keep records that they can then defend through their internal governance, that this isn't just another bribe to a police officer for a tip-off about a celebrity raid or whatever. But even if it was, it's still left to the politicians to deal with. This is not a direct recommendation of Leveson.
Well, I'm
a mere assertion from Nick cannot turn it into one.
Can I just say... I mean, I agreed with actually some of the things that Natalie was saying, if we can bring it back to that. This whole naivety about... everybody in this room has probably read a story that the police have leaked to a journalist. Okay? That's most of the stories that you've read and probably enjoyed have come from that. Don't stop that. You know, the police leak stories, they need to. Whistleblowers, we need them. What really Leveson brought out was the power structure at the top, the over-close relationship between the press, the politicians and the police. That's the thing that has to be broken up. Under New Labour, I mean, I work for the Mail under New... I have never... When Campbell, Alistair Campbell, was running press under New Labour, and he's still the guy who tried to ruin the BBC, but is on the BBC every fucking night.
That's disgraceful.
Alistair Campbell, I have never... When I was at the Mail, I have never seen politicians crawl to a newspaper the way they did to the Mail, OK? And so I would like some kind of separation between this idea that politicians that can't stand up to the Daily Mail. You can stand up to the Daily Mail. The idea that the Sun won the election and lost Kinnock the election, that's all been disproved. People don't buy newspapers. People will vote for different reasons. Less and less people will vote anyway. The thing is, one of the things I would have liked to have seen come out of Leveson that didn't come out was this break, and Natalie mentioned it, the Westminster Village. The only way you can make it as a journalist in Westminster, especially if you're a woman, not that I, well, can say that anymore, but...
you're still a woman to me, Suzanne.
You know, when I was first sent down to Westminster and I said, well, how'd you get them to talk to you? They said, wear a short skirt. Things have got a little bit better, but the way that you get stories from politicians, and Evan will know this, and I don't mean this critically, is that journalists hang out with politicians, they take them to lunch, they get them drunk, they say things off the record, and then it gets into the papers. Now,
well, Leveson wants a record of all of that now, incidentally.
No, well,
every meeting with journalists and politicians, you know.
That might be the bit I agree with. A record of a drunken lunch with some politicians I've been out with, I would actually like to see
published.
It's not
true. So Leveson says there should be a record of meetings between editors and proprietors and government ministers so that deals on access to justice, so conditional fee agreements, for example, are not stitched up, that B-Sky B broadcasting ownership rights are not stitched up in private. He specifically says that none of his recommendations relate to the contents between journalists and politicians, for example. But he does say that the police should not sell stories to journalists, okay? And that's why, because that is corrupt, okay? And the police are not, I have to say, Nick, this paragon of virtue... And
I've never
Suzanne,
said that,
that only ever sells
like,
only ever
like
sell stories about criminals
language.
With swag bags.
No,
they often sell stories to discredit people who are criticising them. Okay, so the idea that there's something virtuous in a public official making money on the side by selling normally an unreliable story to a tame journalist. It's not journalism,
is it? Evan, can I just answer that? Evan, you know, you are no different, really, from the Richard Littlejohns and all the rest of
Thank
them.
Thank you.
The only difference, you know...
My salary is somewhat different.
You are inaccurate, you are jibing, you fail to understand that people can disagree with you on points of principle, and worst of all, when you're cornered, when you're in trouble, you resort to crude insults and crude falsifications.
Hang on a minute, Nick. I know you're building up to a peroration, but I'm going to throw it to Natalie now, because I know you've been waiting to speak for a while.
We're in danger of caricaturing too far here. What I would like to do is try and bring it back to the reason why we had the Leveson report in the first place. And that does come back to Suzanne's points, very important points, that this was to do with institutionalised corruption at the largest selling British newspaper, that nobody felt, no institution, no politician, no police, had the power to hold it to account, right? Not the Information Commissioner, nobody, literally nobody, felt they could hold it to account. And at one point last year, we came within, you know, a cat's whisker of getting, you know, the largest owner of newspapers taking over yet more power within the news environment with B-Sky B buyout. Now, what Leveson has tried to do is create a system where that some of that power, not all of it, I agree there are other issues that also need dealing with, particularly around ownership and plurality, but what we have here is an attempt to at least put into place, actually, no, you cannot get away with that anymore. Sure. There will be a system that will hold you to account, and it won't be you holding yourself to account anymore. There will be somebody watching over that.
One institution did hold, and I utterly agree with you.
Guardian did, yes.
The Guardian, okay. The press did.
I have to say, in all of it, it was incredibly difficult to get any coverage at all until it got into the point at which Leveson reported, and then it was all anti-Leveson. Up until that point, the majority of coverage on the Leveson inquiry, which was really very press-worthy, news-worthy, was minimal.
It was absolutely minimal. The Guardian and Private Eye, and on the BBC
Guardian
as well, and rightly so.
If you look at it across the board, if you take it
I agree with you that Leveson was important. The idea that it would sell newspapers, that it was newsworthy. If I was editing a newspaper, I wouldn't have put Leveson on the front page every day because people wouldn't buy it. I'm sorry, it's just a fact. And I would, do you know what? I want more newspapers. When I was very sad when the News of the World went. I want more bloggers. I want more people to express themselves. The idea of closing things down, the idea of Murdoch pulling Harding out of the Times, closing down his UK operation, which was always the threat, which is kind of happening. He may be Satan, whatever, but I want more. I want more stuff. I don't want less stuff. And the result of these people, this incredible puritanical urge to read only what you think, which is like read The Guardian. But I tell you what sells newspapers.
Isn't that your current employer, Suzanne? I think.
Yes, it is for, this week. Does anyone here really understand what sells a newspaper? Can I ask you? Because I can, I know what sells a newspaper. And it is not Leveson. It is number one, sports. Number two, astrology. One of the biggest. No, I'm serious. One of the most highly paid journalists in Fleet Street is
Jonathan Kaner.
£2 million a year and another million off the phone lines. The third thing is obviously my column.
And on that note, I think we'll probably bring the first half to a close. Welcome back for the second half of our Soho Skeptics debate about Leveson. I thought, since journalists love Twitter, I would prove that it hasn't debased our national conversation by reading to you a few tweets from the first half.
Not those.
One of the big things seems to be people say it's spelt skeptic with a C. So you can take that up amongst yourself later. David Aronovich is sad that he can't be here. He's watching Don't Tell the Bride. Freedom of speech is essential, but the beer here is too expensive. And a request to every one of you, if you're going to tweet Phil tonight, do me a solid and stick the hashtag SohoSkeptic on the end. Cheers. And one from Natalie Guest, which I'm afraid we won't be reading out as it's before the watershed. But thank you, Natalie. We've got a couple of roving mics, so what I'm going to do is take a couple of questions at a time, and then we'll try and kind of parcel them out just so that we can keep things moving. Could you put your hand up if you would like to ask a question, please? Gentleman here in the green hat, and gentleman here. And then we'll also have one upstairs as well, but I'll take these two first.
Is this working? Yep. Something nobody's actually mentioned on the panel is that one of the Leveson proposals, I'm Danica DeLonger from National Union of Journalists, and we kind of take a position that we don't agree with a lot of what was in Leveson, but we do agree with parts of it. So the pace changes, data protection changes, we're opposing. But nobody's mentioned Leveson's proposal that freedom of the press should be enshrined in the law and in statute. Because actually, there are bigger threats to the media at the moment, and I find the fuss over Leveson and ignoring the bigger things going on to be bizarre. Production orders are one. The number of production orders being demanded of journalists, where journalists are required to give all of their unpublished content to the police, are going up. The second is the management standards group in Murdoch's newspapers, which is absolute cooperation with the police in terms of all journalistic material, sources, background, everything the journalists have put together. Both of those were happening before Leveson. They are unconnected to Leveson. They're far greater threats. And actually putting a proper statute in that defines and defends the freedom of the press to protect sources, to protect their content, is something that we should be pushing for instead of just saying that Leveson is a threat. Let's take the good stuff out of it, drop the bad stuff, but argue absolutely for that and the conscience clause, which are two very positive things that we should be fighting for.
That's probably quite going to cause quite a bit of debate, so let's do that one first. Do you think that you would be happy to accept to not have the regulation reform if we had other things like a conscience clause?
No, I don't think you can have one without the other to have any effect. We do need the conscience clause. At the root of all of this is journalistic independence and integrity and enabling that to really take hold. The conscience clause is one very good route to that. But, you know, as the last speaker just said, having a clause in Leveson which actually enshrines for the first time ever freedom of the press has to be a great step forward, in my view, in that you have to then better define what we mean by public interest journalism, public interest defence. It would be I think it would be crazy to turn our backs on that. This would be the first time ever we could actually, as a nation, turn around and say, no, we have got it, you know, this is freedom of the press. And to be able to turn around, for all journalists to be able to turn around and point to that, would be a massive advantage.
Could I disagree? Sorry.
Well,
it's quite an important point. I'm sorry, I didn't catch your name. Duncan. Yeah. You say enshrine press freedom in law. Now, every dictatorship in the world has a constitution that says there is press freedom, but... Now, compare that with the First Amendment of the American Constitution, which I'll read to you in full, partly because I think that if you ever made a dictator for the day and have the chance to pass one law, you should pass this law. It says, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof or abridging the freedom of speech or of the press or of the right of the people peaceably to assemble and petition the government for redress of grievances, shall make no law. In other words, you keep the state out of it. And whatever the manifold crimes of American democracy throughout since 1776... people have gone back and back and back again to that. The last people to do it was Martin Luther King and the Civil Rights Movement, who used the First Amendment. They had our libel laws. They inherited the English libel laws. They inherited much of the common law, and they used that to strike down the English libel law, to say Congress shall make no laws. One of the reasons why, and I'm sorry if this gets an arcane dispute, why people, including people such as myself, who spent their life writing against both the power of the Murdoch press, but also the arguments they put out, like Chris Blackhurst, like all kinds of other people, are getting very, very worried, is Parliament will make a law, and then they will establish some regulatory, some overseer accountable to politicians.
or counsel to Privy Council if we get some kind of BBC-type arrangement. And that flies in the principle of the most successful free speech legislation, which just says, let's have a free society, let's have a robust society. It will be messy, but keep the politics out of it.
Can I really come back on that? Because it's a really important issue, that you can't just say, let's have a free society when there is massive inequality and lack of access to power amongst individuals. There's really no such thing as freedom for the majority of people trying to make those points of view, which is precisely why you get something, if we're going to quote Acts, the European Human Rights Act. Yes, everybody has the right to freedom of expression, okay. But in the Article 10.2, which is far less read and cited, qualifies that by saying the exercise of these freedoms, since it carries with it duties and responsibilities, may be subject to such formalities, conditions, restrictions or penalties as are prescribed by law and are necessary in a democratic society. But it's really important, Nick. Because actually what we have is you're saying there is... Everybody has equal access to these freedoms. But that's what's assumed when anybody says freedom of expression this way, we can't possibly curtail it. Actually, we have massive inequality in people's access to that freedom. What we're trying to do, what Leveson is trying to do, is actually say that here we are holding to account the powerful who have for too long run roughshod over the powerless.
Well, there's 2 points to that. The first is this. You can stop any reform by saying the best is the enemy of the good. You can say until we have an entirely equal society, nothing matters.
And you can resist anything by saying we just ignore that altogether. And actually,
if you had any knowledge of my writings, you know I've never done that. The second is this. You say holding the powerful to account... If this whole Leveson episode had been out, hold the powerful account, James Hunt would have gone. Jeremy Hunt would have gone. David Cameron would be in massive political trouble. Rupert Murdoch would not be in control of B Sky B. All of their careers would be politically impossible. This is not what has happened. The great thing about democracy is we're meant to be able to reform. But I'm starting to despair of our ability to reform, partly because of the banking crisis, where nothing really much is happening. And then Leveson suddenly becomes about not holding the powerful to account, not holding Rupert Murdoch's account, not holding David Cameron's account, not holding Jeremy Hunt to account, but a generalised system, which is, even if you disagree with me and Suzanne, you have to admit there are big dangers there, and these dangers will grow as the money for independent journalism withers. It could well be, in my worst nightmares I imagine, could well be you are better off being rich and powerful in the early 21st century than you were in the late 20th.
Evan, I know he's been waiting to make a point.
Firstly, I think we would be appalled if we set up a judge to sack politicians. It's politicians. In the end, it's the Prime Minister must be accountable for his decision over whether Jeremy Hunt should have been sacked for his blaming of his SPAD, his failure to oversee his special advisor. I'm no fan of Jeremy Hunt, but I wouldn't be a fan of a judge set up to investigate the relationship of politicians with the press, making recommendations within for cabinet reshuffles. And indeed, we saw with the Andrew Mitchell affair that not everything, you have to look behind some of the things that look quite newsy. And it's clearly, if there is an establishment stitch-up, it's not Leveson. It's the sight of the newspaper proprietors and editors trooping into Downing Street after Leveson for a private meeting with the Prime Minister, who did a deal with them to say, you treat me well in your newspapers at the next election, and I will not deliver something that Leveson said was essential, which was the guarantee that independent self-regulation, if it's set up to get the advantages, the incentives that I talked about in terms of protection of costs, that would be effective and independent. That was a stitch-up, and that allowed a situation which is far more toxic than anything in a post-Leveson world, which we're not yet in. It allowed the situation where the culture secretary could get her advisor, because there's this kind of deal being structured, to call off or to try and call off a newspaper doing a perfectly reasonable public interest inquiry and expose of MPs' expenses, saying, look, better be careful, because us, the scheme, the side deal we have on Leveson, instead of I will implement it if it's
not
bonkers.
That's your world. Welcome
to it. No, it's not. It's absolutely not. That's the world of anti-Leveson side deals by politicians saying, we set up a judge because we're heavily involved in this. We got a judge to do it because we know we are party pre. And then after the event, coming back and saying, all right, what can you offer me in terms of editorials at the next election, and I'll do something right by you. That is fundamentally corrupt, in my view. It's fundamentally what Leveson argued against, and it is bizarre to see those people who want to see, who are anti-establishment, as I believe, and if I can be personal here, I believe Nick Cohen genuinely is, sort of finding themselves on the side of that sort of stitch-up. Finally, in terms of the American First Amendment, we have the European Convention on Human Rights, which I utterly defend, and I'm delighted that Paul Dacre has announced that his attack on Leveson is going to take the shape of him using his beloved Human Rights Act to claim that Leveson's recommendations are an attack on Article 10, and he's going to prostrate himself before the European Court judges. It's a beautiful thing to see. He's entitled to do it. I don't think he'll be successful, but if he is, I will be the first to say, let's not implement Leveson. But there's not a shred of good legal argument that I've found that suggests that he would be right.
Thanks, Evan.
The difference between...
The
difference between the Americans and us is we have the BBC, they have Fox News. You decide.
Suzanne, funnily enough, we haven't had a chance to talk about the BBC, and isn't there an argument to say that one of the problems that we have is that the online news market's so hard to make money because the BBC exists and is a competitor that is funded by tax money?
That is part of it. But just to answer some of the things that Duncan said, I agree with you. And just to bring it back to a kind of, I suppose, more human level about power and who has power and who gets power and who gets to be a journalist and who gets to be, you know, Nick Cohen and who gets to be me and things like that.
Anyone who wants to be Nick Cohen is more than welcome. I'm tired of it.
But one of the terrible things that's happened in journalism is that it is now entirely middle class. It is entirely fueled by nepotism. People like me would never have got a job now. I mean, it's just the truth. So the media class and the political class of clones that come out of Oxbridge with their PPE, whatever it is, are the same people. And then everyone moans and says, oh, God, you know, they're all the same. I can't be bothered to vote because they're all the same. They are all the same, and they are very close to a lot of journalists that are all the same. If we talk about, and you asked me about the internet and open access journalism, and that's the kind of model that we are working towards, and I know I work for The Guardian, but I would say comment is free is pretty much a failed experiment. Sorry about that, but that's what I think. Because open access, I mean, I use Twitter a lot, and I'm rude and horrible, and obviously that's got me into trouble this week. But I use Twitter to engage because I'm engaging with people. I'm not really very much engaged with people on comment is free. What worries me a lot now in with the internet is that if you write a column, and I'm paid, so I've had my say, you know, you have your say, is that what produces online hits is always stuff about... I tell you what produces online hits. It's, you know, that James Dean, the porn star. It is not an interesting piece about what's going on in Mali, you know. There are lots of things that are really, really wrong with journalism at the moment and that really I would really like to see changed. And Leveson just doesn't touch any of it for me. I mean, I would like a working-class person who hadn't got a degree to be able to walk into a newsroom and learn something. And I have seen that. I saw it 20 years ago, and I haven't seen it since. And I think that's a really sad thing, because it's like democracy. If you do not have a press that represents people, and again, it's mostly men, not women, If you do not have a press that represents people, and you do not have a political establishment that represents people, this is why you get this horrible kind of conspiracy of dunces, you know? That's what I would say.
On that slightly depressing note, I'm going to go to a next question. Sorry, this gentleman here I know was waiting.
I see that you've been touching on a topic quite a lot, and I want to ask the magnitude of importance of the psyche of the reader base there is for newspapers and online journalism and blogging.
Sorry, can you explain the psyche in what
sense? Of psyche, you know, how it affects the psyche and what people already know about the reader base.
So in terms of how has the move to online and more online readers, how has that affected journalism?
Well, no, I mean, it's a two-way thing. Journalists knowing more about their reader base and their reader base influencing journalism. Mm.
Evan, do you want to take that one?
I'm just not sure I understood the question. If you're saying about that, I mean, one of the things that came up at Leveson was that the public interest was defined by what interests the public, some people said. And I think what's absolutely vital is that there is a definition and an understanding of what the public interest is, because public interest is the key divide here. As I've said, we're very keen, as was Leveson, to ensure that not only is public interest journalism, of which we have a great deal of brilliant stuff in this country, protected, it's actually nurtured through having more public interest defences. That's something we're calling for, which Leveson didn't go so far as calling for. But it comes back to something that Natalie said earlier. If, because you often heard the press say that they were a vital part of the democratic deal, okay? The Fourth Estate was critical, shining a light. If there was any other industry with such extensive corrupting connections with the police force and politicians, and indeed an industrial scale cover-up, it's not so much what the journalists did in terms of hacking, but the conspiracy to cover up, the whole of journalism would have been on it like at a flash. Okay, but because it was their own area, there was a couple of journalists in a couple of newspapers, and that was it. And we needed the New York Times to do the job. So I have to say that I don't think that journalism is well served by the current British newspaper industry. And all we're urging is that they get their act together after 7 decades of saying, "Just give us one more chance to get rid of the poor practice." Whether it's, and some of it's not illegal. You know, it's not necessarily illegal to harangue and harass innocent people to the extent to which they become ill and stressed. It's an abuse of power, and they say that they want to tackle it, but in the end they never do. And what we're seeing now, post-Leveson, is exactly what we saw post-Calcutt. We had the same sort of people arguing that it is Zimbabwe, if you have any independent self-regulation, that is monitored by an independent statutory body. It's Nick. Not true. We shouldn't believe it.
Ladies and gentlemen, you've just seen a master politician at work.
I thought I was Richard Littlejohn.
That's a very nice thing to say about Lib Dem.
A master ex-politician at work. That had nothing to do with your question, which I think I'm right in saying, so was this. Now that newspapers know what articles are hit, how does that affect what newspapers...
Well, what it actually tells about the base, there's a predictive element to it as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, my answer fights against quite strongly, because as Suzanne said, there are certain things you can write about, and you know, sex. Anything about on The Guardian, which is just...
Israel,
God almighty. You know, it's like covering yourself in snake attraction oil and throwing yourself into a snake pit. Religion. And sometimes you can get too much truth, you know? Sometimes you don't want to know. 2 weeks ago, I did a column about... Have you heard of the Magnitsky case? Sergei Magnitsky, who is this Russian lawyer, uncovers this vast fraud, is by the Interior Ministry. He makes an official complaint about how his Interior Ministry policemen have worked with criminal gangs. He's taken to prison, and he's effectively tortured and murdered. I took special care of this, because one of the Interior Ministry policemen is now using our wonderful libel laws, which, you know, God's sake, why can't we get them checked? One of the lines to sue Bill Browder, the man whose tax money was stolen in London, because Browder is getting Magnitsky laws passed all over the world. There's a special interest because the libel lawyer he's got representing him, Karpov, the secret policeman, is on the board of the Scott Trust, which controls the Guardian and Observer, is there to guard our morality. My editor didn't for a moment say, Nick, you can't write this. Nick, you can't do it. I did it. And you did, and you can see how many hits it has. Not very many. This interior policeman may be an entirely innocent, malign man, though how on earth a retired Russian police officer can afford hundreds upon hundreds of thousands of pounds to afford the most expensive libel lawyers and PR men probably in the world is beyond me, but we'll see when the case goes. This could be a major scandal. That got about 77 retweets. Last week, when, I don't know, Julie was writing something, wasn't she? I can't remember. Julie was writing something. I wrote about dicks, I wrote about penises, I wrote about how an awful lot of homophobes, a lot of evidence suggests this, are really closet cases. Thousands and thousands of hits. Yeah. So, you know, do you want them? The danger for newspapers, incidentally, is this. It's not that editors just follow the hits. It's that The money so goes out of it. This is why I won't keep repeating myself, but I do feel, when I listen to the speakers opposite, that we're stuck in the 20th century. That world of the press barons, it's just vanishing. It is just vanishing. The money is disappearing from advertising. What you might get is only newspapers that can follow the hits. Ian Hislop makes a wonderful point about, go on the Daily Mail website. In the paper, there's still all the stuff, left-wings among you, there might even be some conservatives here. Right? Who am I to agree with? The left-wings among you always hated about the Daily. Hi! Welcome!
Hello!
always hated. You know, the Richard Littlejohns, the Peter Hitchens, all the rest of it. Go down the website, there is no even right-wing politics anymore. It's just celeb story, celeb story, celeb story, celeb story, celeb story. Because that's where the market
Thanks,
is.
Thanks, Nick. Can I bring in Natalie? I know you have something to say.
I mean, I do really want to argue against that notion that the press barons are a dying breed. Actually, what the news proprietors are doing and the multinational corporations that run the most powerful news organisations doing, they are becoming more powerful. And the likes of the other smaller voices, which actually Suzanne spoke very eloquently about trying to get out there, they are struggling more and more to be heard. They might be able to speak, but they're not necessarily being heard. And there's a real issue there with an accumulation of power. If we come back to the question about the psyche, there's some really interesting research done on a comparison with the US and the UK around, and it's about broadcasting, so it's slightly different, but what it's looking at are the levels of public knowledge. Okay, so it's very different kind of debate. But what it shows is that the level of public knowledge in a system which has no public service broadcasting at all is massively, massively less than in a society which has public service broadcasting. Now, that is not talking about commercial benefits or what audiences buy, whatever, but it is talking about public knowledge. And if we are going to link news with a democracy, then that matters. That really counts.
Natalie, would you like the press to be regulated like television?
No.
Thank you.
Would people pay a licence? Would people pay a licence?
That's a lone conservative, by the way, ladies and gentlemen. His name is Robert and he doesn't bite.
would people like to pay a licence fee for a better press? They would.
Well, Suzanne, can I ask you, if the last week has taught you anything, that what Natalie said about the smaller voices not being heard, is that surely now everybody has a much greater chance to be heard. More people are blogging, more people are tweeting.
They are, and one of the things that you, having judged a blogging prize, that you learn is, and I hate to be snotty about this, but, everybody's a DJ in their own living room when they're blogging, aren't they? The old-fashioned skills of editing, word length, speaking to, knowing who your audience is, all these things that make journalism, good journalism, what it is, aren't there. They are there in some blogs. I'm generalising. But I can't tell you, ever since I've been writing, the number of people who come up to me and say, you know, I've got opinions, I could do a column, and I've given up, I just say, fine, do one. Because everybody's, it's like the idea that everyone's got a novel in them. Everyone's got a bad novel in them. And everybody's got a couple of columns in them. The art of it is to keep it going for a long time and to keep on reading and learning and knowing stuff. And the trouble with blogs is, some blogs is that it is, when I was judging a blogging competition, it was just after the riots, and lots of us, all of us, none of us knew exactly what to make of the riots, and just before the a year or so ago. And I read many a blog that said, I don't really know what to say about the riots, but I have to write a blog about it. And I just thought, Christ, where are editors? I mean, because part of journalism, whether you're a blogger or whether you're or you're a filmmaking TV programs, is having a good editing and good... And what encourages people is almost like mentoring, mentoring people, saying, you know what, this is a great thing to write about. Nick wouldn't be the journalist he is if someone at some point hadn't told him stuff. Is this not true, Nick? Yeah. And I wouldn't, if I had only ever insisted, no, you can't cut that sentence out of my copy because it's so bloody important. We learn from other people, and the trouble with blogging is that there is nobody, there's no kind of, if you like, authority or just people who know, or professionalism. And I would like, I suppose, people to say what they like and they can have free expression. But if my right to free expression on Twitter is not being able to swear, for instance, it's ridiculous. It's just absolutely ridiculous. I mean, The Guardian have phoned me up this week and told me how to do social media.
That is a brave, brave person who's taking that on. And I think on that note, I'll move on to the next question. I know I should take some of you from upstairs. I can see, I don't know where we've got our mic up there, so I'll put you down for next.
We don't have a mic, so I'll have to shout.
Right, okay, then shout.
I will shout. I'm talking about the regulation of television. And a lot of the journalists from the tabloid side said, well, with Leveson, you won't have great stories like Savile. The thing about the Savile allegations is that they first appeared in an ITV documentary. ITV is regulated by Ofcom, which is an independent regulator. So, and then the newspapers all piled in. So I think it's a terrible false argument to say that statutory underpinning will make journalism risk averse and
cowed
state.
I'll take one. So Nick first.
Mark Thompson. I was going to say that the last director of BBC, but they come and go so quickly. It is second before last. Actually, very generously, considering I'm not one of these BBC lovelies at all. But I would defend the BBC, and I find the attacks on the BBC commercially driven, and I think it would be very good if we followed the American system, where every time the BBC reports on the Murdoch press, it declares an interest, and every time the Murdoch press reports on the BBC, it declares an interest. But Mark Thompson made a very good point, which is something you need to think about. The BBC is a state broadcaster. It gets all its money from the state. Where does its independence come from? Via the state. The state controls its revenue stream. It can set the licence fee. Fine.
Thanks. We'll get to as many people as possible.
Mark Thompson made a very important point. He said the BBC's independence depends on a free media around it. For instance, if the BBC was on its own and got the MP's expenses scandal, or if the BBC had been offered the MP's expenses documents first, it could never have covered the story. First of all, because investigative journalism, as Bismarck once said about sausages and justice, the less you know about how it's made, the more you respect it. Investigative journalism is always a bit dangerous. The expenses scandal, people paid money for stolen goods to get those documents. If the BBC had run it first, all hell would have broken loose, who's political masters. But the fact that there's a newspaper, the Telegraph, that can run it all, then the BBC can cover the story. One of the things to watch as
as the old dead tree media, or what people call us legacy press, which I find rather depressing, as we die back, will politicians go for the BBC more? Will they think, well, it's now the BBC's decision to run stories? You know, they're not doing it because they're just following up something that's been in The Guardian or The Telegraph, the National Times. They're doing it for their own reasons, and we can get them for that.
Thanks, Nick. I think this lady was making a point about doctors and other professions being regulated. Is that right?
Yeah, well, I mean, not everyone can be a doctor. Everyone can write. Everyone can broadcast now.
Well, no,
everyone thinks they can write, yeah.
Sorry, let's hear from this lady.
Well,
Thank you.
All of you people applauding that, very sensible point. What if you're right? This is an audience of skeptics, many of whom will write and publish yourselves and have had to think about audience friends. Where do you leave yourself? Suppose everything Evan and Natalie says is right. I don't believe it, but suppose they are. You will have a privileged club of established newspapers with cheap arbitration procedures, whereas the little guy, the woman writing her blog on her own, will be entirely outside this gilded circle. And as many people have said, Leveson tries to get round this. He tries to say, yeah, but if you have all these, as I say, this is the English establishment talking to you, and you should never trust it, especially when it comes dressed in left-wing clothing. They say, it's all right, it's all right, as long as you follow all these procedures. And they say, we're a small business, or we're just some person producing our own little blog or anything. We can't afford to do it. They will be left to the full horrors the full horrendous costs.
Okay, I'm going to ask them. Sorry, I know, Natalie, I know you're very keen to come back on this,
it's
Nick.
Still
I could stop you there. Natalie.
But, I mean, it's actually not true at all that actually it's highly likely to be a completely sliding scale of people, of payment according either to revenue brought in or to numbers or whatever. There will be a sliding scale so anybody can have access to that, to whatever the self-regulatory body, the benefits of being part of a self-regulatory body offer. So that simply isn't true.
But Natalie, isn't it fair enough to say we can't regulate journalists in the same way that we regulate doctors, for example, because they have special privileges, they can perform special procedures, yes. Whereas everybody can be a journalist. So that simply can't work.
Which is why... The difference between ITV and BBC, which is statutory regulation, it's not state regulation, it's statutory regulation. No one seriously thinks that Ofcom is run by the government. It pisses off the government, as we saw around the B Sky B business. Okay, that is what ITV have, and indeed it's what doctors and lawyers have. What Leveson proposes for the press is not state regulation, as I've said. It's not statutory regulation. It's self-regulation, independent self-regulation, verified by an independent body.
Not appointed.
That's the whole point.
A law drawn up by the politicians.
Absolutely. Okay. All laws. I mean, you'll find that there's this shocking thing, which puts journalists in court, called contempt of court.
Congress,
I think you'll find
that
was passed by politicians, thank goodness, to preserve the rule of law against newspapers that breach contempt of court, where that actual prosecution...
But contempt of court applies to Evan. It applies to you whether you're a journalist or non-journalist.
So when you have statute...
It's a law for Evan. You are arguing for a special legal system...
No, not at all.
...that surrounds one group of people.
No,
I'm
voluntary.
Arguing for one law for all.
Absolutely not. So Leveson recommended... Leveson recommended, and contempt of court does apply to everyone, so does libel. Leveson said that if you want to, as the press, because you have the power to speak to millions, therefore you can cause real damage, you have the option of joining an independent self-regulator that will give you advantages in costs. However, the statute that stems from his regulations is very clear, and it's on our website. Our proposal says that if it wasn't reasonable because you're not a commercial blogger, for example, not a significant news publisher, you will be at no disadvantage if you are, in that sense, not part of it. We know what we're talking about. We're talking about the large newspapers, the Desmonds of this world, who walk out of self-regulation, okay, aren't prepared to pay for it, and yet seem to think that they, therefore, shouldn't pay any penalty for that when they're abused. abusing their monopoly. So I want to stress that even though ITV were able to do Savile as when they were statutory regulated, Leveson calls for self-regulation, albeit if you want to get the benefits of self-regulation through cheaper ways of defending yourself in court, you have to be verified, and the best person to verify that is an independent statutory body not appointed under our scheme by politicians.
So, Nick, I guess the question is, what do you do then with a Desmond or a private eye who say, I'm not going to be regulated,
I promised Helen, and I said, this is the last thing I have to say, I won't say anything again.
I don't believe
matter.
It, but go on.
Doesn't matter. There was a very telling moment, which to my shame as a Labour supporter and opponents of the Liberal Democrats and the Conservatives, came when Michael Gove was being interviewed by Leveson. And after this oily barrister had started mocking John Stuart Mill, Gove just said to Leveson, what happens if Private Eye refuses to go along with your regulators, which Evans says is voluntary? And as a journalist, I often listen for what's not said as much as what is said. You know, and what Leveson didn't say was this. Leveson didn't say, I am in favour of serious investigative journalism in Britain. My inquiry is no threat to that. I'm only interested in the criminals and celeb hounds who have debased our national life. I'm only interested in Rupert Murdoch. Private Eye has, along with The Guardian, I'm sorry, The Guardian's my plug, never mind, has broken most of the stories that cause this inquiry. Of course I don't want to impose new laws on Ian Hislop. Of course I don't want to impose new laws and new burdens on Private Eye and The Guardian. He didn't say any of that because, as I said, this is the English establishment. Never trust them. What he said was this, and this is still in the report. He said, well, if Ian Hislop won't have anything to do with the Press Complaints Commission. Quite rightly, mind you, but there you go. He said, well, look, if someone refuses to join Evans' supposedly voluntary scheme, and then they are sued for libel, they will be liable for the costs of litigation in privacy and defamation and other cases. Any sceptics here who were involved in the Simon King Singh case will know those costs can be enormous. They will be liable even if they win the case. That goes contrary to the principles of natural justice, contrary to the best principles of the common law. You know, so even they win. And then Leveson goes on to say someone else. If enough newspapers don't join, it will be deemed a failure and there will be control.
Is that a fair summation of what would happen, Evan?
It's not. Firstly, because the whole point about the self-regulator, in order to be approved for protection in costs, has to offer an arbitral scheme which allows people who aren't rich, okay, to be able to get justice. Okay, so you strip most of the lawyers out, you have arbitration. Okay, if you choose that arbitration, which is cheap, you cannot go to court. Okay, so if you refuse to be part of that scheme, as let's say the Daily Express, and you force someone, Christopher Jeffries, say, the McCanns, these are real people, ordinary people, to go and sue you in court if they can afford it, risking, in many cases, their livelihoods because of the risks of paying your costs. What the rules say is that if you have chosen not to offer the cheap, accessible system for ordinary people without means to be able to deal with you in terms of getting justice, then you will be liable for the excess costs that you're forcing them to pay. That is natural justice. I said, if this is challenged and defeated in the European courts, I'll eat whatever hat it is that Nick would probably throw at me. I don't believe it will happen, but then I would oppose the Leveson recommendations. But there isn't any serious...
Thanks, Evan. We're going to run out of time, so I'm going to take a very quick couple of questions. Gentleman at the back there on the end of the row, and lady up there on the balcony, who will have to shout after this, but...
It seems to me that the balance that's being presented now, post-Leveson, is that in order to have fine investigative journalism, to pay for that, we have to have salacious crap. Is that the truth? Is that the world we now have to live in?
Suzanne, is that the truth?
Yeah. I mean, that is the whole difficulty about free speech. I heard Peter Preston today talking about the row that I got involved in with the Julie Birchall thing. free speech is offensive, it's raucous, tabloid culture is that. These are all values that I would absolutely defend. And they're not the easiest values to defend. I wonder what newspapers Evan reads, you know, because I tell you what, the Daily Mail, 40% of those people vote Labour. It has the biggest female readership of any paper. Now, you may not like these facts, and you may go on the Mail Online and say, oh, my Christ, that woman's let herself go. Or you may be better than that and read The Guardian. Do you know what? I don't care. What I want is as many, as I keep saying, as much expression as possible, as much freedom as possible. And in the end, it comes down to, do I believe that the state, that politicians, or ex-politicians in Levin's case, are for freedom? You know, fundamentally, I don't.
Natalie, do you read Mail Online?
Yeah. I read the Mail Online, I read all the newspapers actually, and I read most of their online counterparts. It's part of my job. But I, you know, the idea that somehow there is freedom of expression in a thoroughly commercialised and marketised news environment, I think is misplaced. And what's interesting is if you go into other European countries, they have acknowledged this and recognised that there does need to be some subsidisation of the press in other forms. So actually what they do is they say, if you can show there is a readership for a certain market, say in the Netherlands, then we will subsidise that to get it up and running off the ground. If you go to Norway, they will say, you know, yeah, okay, we can give you some subsidies here. So it's, you know, and what that is not state-sponsored press. What it is...
No, it isn't,
actually. It isn't at all. What it's doing is it's giving seed funding to get something off the ground, which then may be non profit making, and so there are. It's entirely possible to conceive of a world whereby you might levy something like Google, who pays no tax at all in this country, a tiny percentage of their profit that could then go into some kind of public trust fund that people could apply to for new news startups that would diverse ecology of the news environment.
Can I give a different answer to my colleague? I mean, I think that I'm happy to read salacious crap as long as it does not, and there's plenty of it that doesn't do this, as long as it doesn't breach the rights of other people, and as long as the news gathering methods, and there are perfectly legal news gathering methods for salacious crap, are lawful. So yes, and sadly it seems that there is, it is difficult to do investigative journalism, it's expensive, but the reason that I am not bothered by the attacks on me that we've heard, Richard Littlejohn, ex-politician, is that I'm very comfortable, and I don't mean to sound sort of pompous about this, in my support for free speech. So I support Suzanne Moore, but I was also on Twitter, one of the few people possibly in this room who supported Jan Muir's right to do her thing, okay, and be offensive to gay people in the Stephen Gately case, and not have this big Twitter storm saying reported to the PCC in Saka. I helped abolish blasphemy, seditious libel, criminal defamation, and helped set up the libel reform campaign. So I'm perfectly comfortable in my skin as a free speecher. And in that capacity, there is nothing in Leveson that is endangering free speech or good public interest journalism. And indeed, Hacktoff goes further and argues for greater protection, to seize the opportunity of legislation to provide for more public interest defences to nurture investigative journalism. So that's why I'm not bothered by these personal attacks from my right.
Thanks, Evan. I'm just going to take... probably one last final question, I think, as we're running out of time. Lady up in the gods.
Hi, I have one brief question. I heard Natalie speak earlier about inequality, and I'm just wondering how press regulation, what's the correlation between that and helping create less inequality? Because to me, creating more legal barriers would keep people from accessing that kind of justice, if you're saying people should get justice through those paths, because law is also a privilege, being able to access it. So how is that supposed to create more equality? And another thing is,
Just one. Probably one is probably all we can handle. Natalie.
Yeah, I mean, it comes back to Evan's point that he just made, actually, that the system that Leveson is proposing is actually massively opening up the possibility for those without copious funding to actually go...
It is, Natalie.
So actually go through a system to bring a complaint and not have to pay huge amounts of money. It is, I'm afraid.
So explain to us how it's doing that.
What you have is you have a three-tier system of whatever this self-regulation body will be that will be a kind of enforcement of standards of the code committee drawn up by the industry largely. You have the complaints handling system and you have this arbitration wing. The arbitration service is for people to go to and to say, look, without massive costs, can we deal with this issue?
So, Nick, you've been a huge opponent of our libel laws. Why don't you like that idea of an arbitration system?
Because what there ought to be is that arbitration system ought to be for everyone who writes and publishes. It is not. It is for, Evan preposterously says it's a voluntary group, which would be a statutory group, of the existing dead tree media. If you, a colleague of mine was telling me a story about the editor of the Camden New Journal, which is a little local newspaper, fighting, barely afford to get the reporters on the streets. And he wrote an editorial saying, look, the press has behaved disgracefully, or parts of the press have behaved disgracefully. Don't need to tell me that. I've had my whole life... I mean, I'm very sorry if I'm not joining the popular singing. I don't like the tabloid press. I don't even read it. I don't see the point of reading it. I don't like all these people who just go on, so why read it? I enjoy it. I mean, I've had my entire career editors, not just on the tabloids, on some of the broadsheets and on the BBC and ITV saying, oh, Cohen, you're such an elitist. You go on these things. People don't care about that. They care about sport. They care about sex and celebrity and salacious gossip. Look where their faux populism has got them. Not one of them can stand up, and they had this power to hack phones. I wish I'd known about it. I'd have done some bloody good with it. They had this power to hack phones. Not one of them has yet produced a story that was in the public interest to just go before a jury and say, OK, we broke the law, we did in the public interest, that's fine. The jury will say, as juries always do, OK, not guilty. You don't need to tell me how bad it is. But that is the path. The future is of, for good as well as ill, actually, I don't join in Susan and her depression, is of a more democratised media, a more democratised society, but they will be smaller. And as the editor of the Camden New Law Journal said, the big boys will be all right with this, just like big corporations are fine with bureaucracy. Big corporations, they don't like regulation, they can handle it. Small businesses can't. They can't afford the costs. I go back, I'm sorry to keep emphasising this, we are in a new world and we just need laws that apply to everyone. We can argue on either side where those laws were.
No.
Susan and I will probably ask something far more liberal than other people in this room, but the same law must apply to everybody.
And I'm afraid I'm going to stop you all there. I want to say thank you to our panellists tonight, to Nick and Suzanne and to Natalie and to Evan, who all demonstrated their commitment to arguing the task with people by coming along tonight. And thank you for you all to giving up your evening to come as well. So to the panellists, thank you.
This was a special podcast brought to you by The Pod Delusion. The Pod Delusion is a weekly news magazine show about interesting things. Basically, if you like the sort of thing you've just heard, then you'll like our programme too. You can listen to The Pod Delusion at poddelusion.co.uk. But for now, thanks for listening.